morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I start today's program with a couple of lines from a popular ditty fitting for this last quarter of a year. In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. The rest is history on a very different plane. Half of Earth was rediscovered by a portion of its other half, which overran the Western Hemisphere and decimated the varied civilizations of the so-called New World. And thus we are who we are, half a millennium later, in what was earlier hoped to be the Old World of Asia and the plunder of all its storied riches, but certainly doubled Earth's size scholastically while annihilating its human populations. Our past still lies ahead of us, Lewis Mumford once wrote. Or perhaps, as Richard Stengel says, our future lies behind us. Walt Whitman had something to say on this subject. This is what you should do. Love the earth and sun and the animals. Despise riches. Give alms to everyone that asks. Stand up for the stupid and crazy. Devote your income and labor to others. Hate tyrants. Argue not concerning God. Have patience and indulgence toward the people. Take off your hat to nothing known or unknown, or to any man or number of men. Re-examine all you have been told at school or church or in any book. Dismiss what insults your own soul, and your very flesh shall be a great poem. And that was by Walt Whitman. And my only complaint about it is he should have added women to his speaking of man. And now I wish to read a short story I wrote during the final years of the previous millennium, which I have recently rediscovered in a pile of personal pulp. I wrote it while being perhaps the oldest copy boy on a daily newspaper in the early 1960s, before my descent into the Vietnam War, which changed my personal views on nearly everything I thought real. This little leaf of prose might be pertinent as we Northern Hemisphere inhabitants traverse seasons here at the top of our miniature celestial ball. I call it the second shot. The sky was a chilled wine through the dark and silent trees that caressed the two men setting spark to a small fire in the birth of morning. The rude thrust of pine kindled in the glare that paled the fire as the sun climbed above the frosted peaks. The two men were caught in the orange magnificence, and they sat transfixed in an impossible yearning to be a part of all they saw and felt. For several embracingly beautiful moments, their souls communed in silence, each understanding the rarity of these things, and each striving to grasp it before it fled forever. The larger of the two broke the spell with a futile attempt to express emotion with inadequate control. "You know, Tom," he flushed with well-being and companionship, the only answer to thoughts in a language he could never understand, "I'm damn glad you're my neighbor." He smiled expansively. "You and Debbie are the best neighbors me and the missus have ever had." The other man jerked his head embarrassedly. "Goes for me too, Hal," he choked and grinned and slurped at the cup of coffee just poured from the old-time blackened pot squatting in the center of the fire. "Hal," portly and middle-aged, used a rag on the handle of the pot and poured the black syrup into his chipped cup. I remember when I was up here last season, he looked around with a pleasured grin. Why, it was almost this exact spot, a six-pointer, Tom. I almost hated killing him after I'd already done it. He half smiled wryly. Tom, young, rather skinny and pleasant-mannered, but with something intangibly hard about him, smiled at his friend without saying anything. I'm glad I thought of bringing you, Hal continued, as he bit off the end of a cigar and passed one to his companion. These are good grounds. We'll have us a kill before tomorrow. Maybe a trophy. I'm looking forward to some of that venison stew you've been bragging about. Ah, the portly man exclaimed grandly. A treat is in store, my boy. The palate will be pleasured and envious. Within an hour, strapped into packs and carrying their rifles, they were climbing along an ancient and worn game trail. The narrow path wandered along the sides of mountains, sometimes precariously across slides, sometimes into dry, baked, and tangled gullies. The mountains smelled pungent of life and death. At times, the two men walked into dark and musty groves. Other times, they stumbled and slipped on barren and crumbling granite, rotten with age. The sun climbed slowly in the sky, and miniature beads of sweat seeped through heavy shirts. A breeze fought for life, but constantly was subdued or whisked elsewhere, and the day was sluggish noon. Constantly, they swiveled their heads upwards, hoping for the familiar silhouette along the forested or bare skylines of the hunchbacked ridges. Early in the afternoon, they heard the distant crescendo of water. Without command, their feet marched faster to the pulse. Squeezed into the narrow and winding passage between two rock and brush-clumped, sun-baked ridges, buried beneath the almost too green and arched trees, a silver ribbon tumbled over itself in 100 trivial rapids. Here the trail ended its quest for life, and here the two men exchanged weary smiles and bent to drink. We'll rest here a minute, the flushed Hal gasped as they sprawled against the young skin of a birch. Our scent will be washed out in a while. We can move. We can move up into those rocks. He breathlessly pointed a stubby finger to a spot several yards up the far slope, shaded by a mutant growth of tangled oak that was one tree trying to be several. It's downwind. Good clear field. Good range. Even with that old John Wayne 30-30 Winchester you're lugging around. Tom smiled at the jibe. As they climbed up to the spot, after crossing the clear running stream, a tangle of thick and dry brush blocked their path. With grinning shrugs, they crashed into the growth. The flat sound that could only be a rifle shot echoed through the narrow basin. With an instinct that is bred of war, Tom threw himself to the ground. At the same instant, with a bewildered horror blanching his face, Hal fell to his knees, clutching desperately at his stomach, where blood was staining the checkered shirt. I'm a hunter, the lingering scream rushed past his twisted mouth in pain. A second shot took away his face. Tom saw a figure running through the brush to his left, crashing towards the stream. Without thought, he came to his feet and raised the old Winchester to his cheek and levered two quick rounds that caught the man in the back, flinging high his arms and somersaulting him out of sight. Hal, he knelt and looked into the bloody slush that had been the face of a friend. He shook his head. He had seen them like this in Korea, squashed like a berry. He rose and searched out the man he had shot. The figure was sprawled over a small and broken down bush that had crumbled with his fall. Two red eyes soaked through his shirt. Tom found the rifle. He felt extremely tired as he peered down the bore. It was blackened and still hot. But a doubt pulled at him. The rifle had been fired, but could he be sure? Then he found the whiskey. The guy was drunk all right, the coroner of the small town said. A damned high count. He yelled he was a hunter, Tom explained, and the bastard shot him again. You saw his face. That still don't give you the right to kill him, drunk or not, the aging police chief intoned harshly. What would you do? The coroner retorted. This boy just reacted to a friend's getting killed. I just thought I was back in Korea, Tom said helplessly. I didn't have time to think, to even get mad. He gestured vainly with his hands in an attempt to amplify his meaning. It was like Hal was a buddy, you know, a buddy down in combat. And, easy, son, the coroner patted his shoulder. I don't think you got much to worry about. That second shot saved you. No jury would touch you. That second shot took away any excuse the guy could come up with. He looked at the scowling face of the police chief. I don't reckon we'll ever know the reason he fired the second time. Maybe he was scared. Who knows? But any verdict, and the coroner swiveled his gaze to the tired and saddened expression, any jury would call what you did self-defense. It was a long mountainous road home, and at the end of it, a woman waited for her man. He would have to tell her. Grandly arching above the eroded asphalt road, the dark pines danced in the windy rhapsody that tarnished the sunless sky. The day was dead. Tom would miss Hal. The shutdown fight has finally given Democrats leverage. They should use it. By Robert Reich. The government has effectively been shut down since Trump returned to office, as officials clamp down on work they oppose. The United States government is officially closed. Agencies and departments designed to protect consumers, workers, and investors are now officially closed, as are national parks and museums. Most federal workers are not being paid. As many as 750,000 could be furloughed, including those who are required to remain on the job, like air traffic controllers or members of the U.S. military. So-called mandatory spending, including Social Security and Medicare payments, are continuing, although checks could be delayed. The construction of Trump's new White House ballroom will not be affected. Shutdowns are symptoms of a government off the rails. Nutrition assistance and all the increased funding for immigration enforcement. There is a deeper irony here. As a practical matter, the U.S. government has been shut down, that's a quote, for more than 8 months since Trump took office this second time. Trump and the sycophants surrounding him, such as Russell Vought, the director of the Office of Management and Budget, have had no compunction about shutting down parts of the government they don't like, such as U.S. aid. They have also moved to fire, furlough, or extend buyouts to hundreds of thousands of federal employees doing work they do not value, such as those working at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. They have impounded appropriations from Congress for activities they oppose, ranging across the entire federal government. On the first day of the shutdown, Vought announced the administration was freezing $18 billion that Congress had appropriated for funding infrastructure in New York City, home to the Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and the House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries. All of this is illegal, but it seems unlikely that courts will act soon enough to prevent the administration from harming vast numbers of Americans. In fact, Trump threatened to permanently fire more federal employees if the Democrats didn't vote to continue funding the government. But nothing stopped him from doing it before the shutdown, and the shutdown presents no greater opportunity for him to do so. In fact, the eagerness of Trump and his lapdogs over the last 8 months to disregard the will of Congress and close whatever they want of the government offers another reason why Democrats should not have caved in. Had Democrats voted to keep the government going, what guarantee would they have had that Trump would in fact keep the government going? Democrats finally have some bargaining leverage. They should use it. Tens of millions of Americans lose their health insurance starting in January because they can no longer afford to pay the sky-high premiums. Trump and his Republicans will be blamed. It would be Trump's and his Republicans' fault anyway. It's part of their big, ugly bill. But this way, in the fight over whether to reopen the government, Americans will have a chance to see Democrats standing up for them. Robert Reich, a former U.S. Secretary of Labor, is a professor of public policy emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley. He is a U.S. columnist for The Guardian, and his newsletter is at the robertreichsubstack.com. His new book, Coming Up Short, A Memoir of My America, is out now. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is engineer of this program. Beware of a hostile occupation of Oregon instigated by America's, with a K, president and would-be Hitleresque dictator who is actually trumping himself by his clinically stupid Caesar Caligula personality disorder. Trump's only hope of staying out of jail after his presidency is to make himself dictator for life.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times-Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.